start of the course, the point has been made that we enjoy three basic sanctions or controls which can be exercised in order to govern our own affairs. The first sanction is political, the second is financial, and the third is moral. The mechanism for getting results via the moral sanction is the use of words. In this section of the course, we propose to explain how sanctions can be used, either on their own or in the best possible combination, to achieve results in terms of self-government. The question to be answered is, how can the individual or electors overcome policies promoting the centralisation of power and reverse these policies towards a process of self-government? Political democracy can only be a reality when a representative is responsible to the electors. Electors, however, cannot expect their representative to move openly against the forces of centralisation, such as the leaders of their own parties, unless the electors themselves make it clear that they will support them to the utmost. It is still a fundamental truth that in a government system like ours, which is loosely called a democracy, electors tend to get the government and representatives they deserve. This means that ultimately the responsibility for government rests upon the individual, upon the elector. The first thing to be understood is the proper relationship between a Member of Parliament and his elector. The reality of the present relationship is that representatives, with few exceptions, have one single objective, and that is simply to stay in power. To do so is to respond to the force that is going to ensure that he maintains his position. Far too often, that force is the political party machine, which enjoys enough sanctions to be able to direct the behaviour of members of Parliament. The elector's objective should be to replace the sanctions of the party machine with those of the elector, so that they can direct the behaviour of their representative. Arthur Cresby, former Member of Parliament for the Queensland seat of Griffith and also a former research analyst in constitutional law, produced a number of small booklets on Parliament and the parliamentary process. In his book, Your Will Be Done, he sums up the obligations of an elector in the following words. It is your legal duty and obligation, and yours alone, to keep your members and senators fully informed at all times of your will. That is your true, lawful relationship with your members and your senators. But what is the sole legal function of a Member of Parliament? Again, to quote Cresby, the sole legal function of a Member of Parliament is to freely advise the Queen, in the government of the country, according to the clearly expressed will of the people on any matter or thing. That is, his sole legal function is to legislate. Cresby expands on that. The representative's sole legal duty is that, like a judge entering his court, he shall enter his House of the Parliament each official sitting day, and with judge-like dignity and decorum, he shall honestly, impartially, and searchingly examine all matters that properly may be placed before him, and with unbiased judgment vote according to his conscience and his sense of legal responsibility. So that is the ideal situation. A Member of Parliament, of course, does respond to the pressure of his electorate if sufficient pressure is exerted. Every MP knows that if a constituent takes the time to write him a letter, then that constituent is not the only person that feels that way. If a parliamentarian receives a letter from a constituent expressing concern on an issue, he understands that for every person who writes to him, there are perhaps 50 others in the electorate who feel the same way. Such action is therefore very significant. Is it any wonder that members are content to obey the instructions of their party leadership when people do not write to them about their concerns? But what is a political party? Cresby makes the following observation. A political party, in fact and in experience, is a device or a mechanism designed to enable manipulators, either elected or non-elected, to obtain and exercise the maximum direct control over the destiny of people, clichés notwithstanding, in accordance with the will of the manipulators and controllers. We have all seen evidence of this. The basic problem is not going to be solved by creating still more political parties and seeking to persuade the electorate that all it has to do is vote for another party and all will be well. The solution is for each individual to encourage his fellows to take some form of political action of their own. Arthur Cresby makes an observation. It must never be forgotten that ordinary people have the legal privilege, if they wish to exercise it, of quietly approaching relatives, friends, acquaintances and others, inviting them to exert their will over their members and senators. It requires no committees, no resolutions, no street marching, no formation of groups, bodies or associations with all sorts of names and titles. Further, says Cresby, all that is required is that an individual with a determination to act lawfully, to write or alter something he doesn't like, and with the initiative to do so, is to write a letter to his member or senator expressing his will to show others and encourage them to do likewise. There are a multitude of issues upon which people have strong convictions, and the simple "My Will" letter is their lawful way of telling their member of parliament. Don't argue that it will not work or that people are stupid. If you feel strongly enough about something, don't just moan and talk about it. Exert your will. It is your personal responsibility to do so, not someone else's. Power in many hands means power in safe hands, as tradition has it. There is an old saying that knowledge is power. Individuals with knowledge certainly have a greater capacity for using power, though obtaining knowledge means individual effort. One of the long-term objectives of this course is to produce people who may be called citizenship facilitators, people equipped with knowledge concerning their different institutions and systems, whether they are financial, economic or political. Individuals who can then work effectively to help provide answers to our problems. A sprinkling of competent people, trained citizenship facilitators, who belong to an organisation, including perhaps political parties, can have a tremendous impact. On the other hand, 1,000 angry, uninformed people, perhaps farmers who are concerned about rising costs, can be quietened by a smooth-talking politician. 1,000 angry farmers can march on Parliament, but that is no threat to a politician. In fact, a politician is much more likely to march at their head and benefit from the resulting newspaper coverage and television stories. But introduce 12 competent citizens into those 1,000 angry people to challenge that politician, and the situation has changed dramatically. Take perhaps a more puerile example. If a bus full of people breaks down before it arrives at its destination, we have a busload who might be quite annoyed with the driver. But no matter how angry they are, the bus will never start again unless one of them has some understanding of mechanics. If that is the case, it may take just a few minutes to change the situation completely. Large, angry groups of people are actually more destructive than helpful. They play into the hands of their opponents, who are adept at manipulating mobs. The first rule of military warfare is to establish a firm and secure base, but the second rule of warfare is to know your enemy, to understand the mechanisms he uses, the systems upon which he depends, and his methods of operation. In addition to that, you should understand your own tools and methods of operation. Evil dominates good whenever evil makes better use of its tools than good does. So the answer to effective political action is to understand your tools, your sanctions, your mechanisms much better than your opposition understands them. This requires training. Our generation is highly informed because we are exposed to more information than ever before. Technology has seen to that. The problem we face here is what in science we would call a higher background noise to meaningful signal ratio. In other words, our information flow contains a lot of rubbish, and it is difficult to tell what is worth remembering. We must be very critical and sceptical about information. We must be selective and demand access to primary sources. It is extremely important that you check the reliability of all sources of information. Don't just rely on the number of times you are told something. They may all be repeating the same original lie unknowingly. Anybody who has been at a controversial event at which the media were present will know what I mean. At a later date, when they see the press reports or the television item, they can often be excused for wondering, is that the same event that I was at? There are other sources of information. There are many small private newsletters produced by dedicated individuals in many different areas of endeavour. Here are a number of examples. An Australian journal which supports CIR takes the form of a tabloid newspaper called Wake Up. There is another one in New South Wales called the Bunyip Press. Another is run by the Citizens Electoral Councils called The Citizen. In the United States, one of the most expensive and prestigious journals is the Executive International Report. The USA has a veritable plethora of different freedom-oriented journals, many of which provide constructive and useful information. Some of the church groups have extremely good journals. For example, the Queensland-based Logos Group produces the Logos Journal. In the UK, there is a valuable journal called Home, while the Canadians produce Speak Up. So there are many and varied sources of information if we take the trouble to search them out. Don't neglect to read books, but don't rely solely upon the established outlets for reliable information. Such naive reliance is not only sometimes dangerous, but may be very misleading. The large and monolithic publishing houses will in most cases decline to touch material which offends established political and financial powers. Popular pulp aimed at the lowest common denominator is the big buck's favourite. Many of the accepted information outlets do not provide all the information required. In fact, there is a wide range of books and booklets that never actually see the light of day unless one actually goes looking for them. They are circulated by small groups and stocked only in specialty bookshops. Some governments even ban certain non-pornographic publications. For example, Canada has a whole list of banned political books. One, such as None Dare Call It Conspiracy, written by Gary Allen, which sold 5 million copies in the rest of the English-speaking world, was banned for many years to Canadians. Cassette tapes are another very useful source of information. They are being used more and more to convey information instead of using the printed word. With the use of modern technology, it is much easier to slip a cassette into a tape recorder and listen to it while one is performing other tasks. Another powerful medium of communication in this age of technology is the video. There are now many groups around Australia producing their own videos to tell the story that the mass media will simply not carry. The use of the video is a very powerful mechanism for the transfer of ideas. For some reason, an individual will believe what comes out of a TV, but he will not listen to the same person face to face. Such is the power of television. The video can be used to multiply resources. For example, instead of having one speaker doing 300 meetings a year, 20 or 30 videos can magnify that speaker's message many, many times. A wide range of courses are available for the development of personal skills. Some courses are designed to teach people to write with better expression, greater discipline, and with more meaning. There are also a number of public speaking groups. There is the Ladies Penguin Club and the Rostrum Organisation, which train people in public speaking and give them the opportunity to practice until they become proficient. A number of other groups provide different courses of their own. For example, there is an anti-subversion course available which teaches how institutions in our free society are sometimes undermined and penetrated by those mistakenly, but sincerely, committed to the centralisation of power, such as Marxists and Fabians. The individual who intends to take some form of action should search out the courses required. It is misleading to believe that one person cannot achieve very much. This is not the case. History does not bear it out at all. In fact, history teaches that one person, one determined person with an objective in mind, can achieve a great deal indeed. For example, it was one man who established the international scouting movement. Baden-Powell had a vision of what he could achieve for young people through an international organisation, and Baden-Powell did not give up until that vision was fulfilled. The Salvation Army was the result of a similar vision by an individual named Booth. There are many movements around the world, very few of which would exist but for the vision of one person. If you want the ultimate example of the power of one, you should consider how Christianity began. It began with one person who, with no technology, vehicles, printing press or television, created a movement that has shaken the world for 2,000 years. Success depends on how great the determination is and how constructive the message is. In Western Australia a number of years ago, a wheat farmer decided that action had to be taken by somebody on the question of abortion. The farmer decided to research the issue as thoroughly as he could and discovered that the proportion of his tax money that was used to fund abortions in Australia each year was approximately $35. He decided, as a matter of principle, to withhold the money that was being taken from him to fund abortions. When his next tax assessment arrived, he deducted $35 and wrote to the tax commissioner, telling him why he had done so. However, he said to the tax commissioner, "I'm not refusing to pay this money, I'm in fact putting it in a separate account. If you can convince my bishop that it should be paid, then I shall accede to it being paid." He then wrote to his bishop, enclosing the cheque, explaining what he had done, and saying that as his spiritual advisor, the bishop was to take some decision about what action should be taken. Fairly quickly, the bishop returned the cheque, saying, "I am afraid it is none of my business. You will have to decide your own taxation affairs," which our farmer decided was most unsatisfactory. He wrote back to the bishop saying, "This is a spiritual choice. This is a spiritual issue. If you believe that the money should be paid to the taxation department, then you go ahead and pay it to them." This created quite an amount of interest in Western Australia. In fact, the farmer eventually went to court and argued that it was immoral for him to fund what he believed was murder, and he was not going to take responsibility for that being done with his money and in his name. He was withdrawing from responsibility in the matter. In the end, he lost the court case, but the point was made, and a number of media outlets right around the state carried the story, and it resulted in a large number of others becoming involved in the anti-abortion campaign in Western Australia. Any person who proposes to take some form of political action hopes to influence and educate others. There are several different ways that this can be achieved. Obviously, you can visit friends, relatives, people in positions of influence. You can telephone them. You can telephone members of parliament, shire councillors, city councillors, any person in a position of influence. Perhaps the most effective form of communication is private correspondence. It is very effective to have your own mailing list if you intend to take some form of regular political action. Keep a list of those people with whom you propose to maintain contact. You may be able to photocopy pertinent articles, newspaper clippings, newsletter articles, to draw their attention to various issues. Cassette tapes are now available fairly cheaply, in bulk. One service organisation in Victoria provides the service of 20 tapes for $25 on a specific issue. This means you can buy 20 tapes and send them to 20 different people for them to listen to. This is a very effective form of communication. Other forms of action could include study groups. Such a group could study a book, a specific issue, or a specific document such as the Constitution. It is an amazing fact that 30% of Australians do not know that they have a Constitution. Worse still, only 1 in 1,000 knows what it says or what its purpose is. It is also possible to hold video nights or to invite a speaker to address a circle of acquaintances. Naturally enough, those who wish to influence others join groups and other movements with similar objectives to their own. This invariably raises the question of group action and group activity. The key word is action, because action is the major basis for morale of any sort. It is necessary to understand something of the nature of the group as distinct from the individual. Individual effort is important. Group effort is, in fact, more efficient, but there is a very big difference between a group and a crowd. A group consists of a few people. A crowd is a very interesting social phenomenon. The British author Aldous Huxley wrote the following: "A crowd has a mental life inferior in intellectual quality and emotionally less under voluntary control than each of its members in isolation." The mental life of a group is not inferior, intellectually or emotionally, to the mental life of the individuals comprising it, and may be, in favourable circumstances, actually superior. Huxley has picked up something that mass political movements such as Marxism have known for many, many years, and that is that a crowd is, in fact, an organism in which the individual submerges his individuality and loses control of his own character, his own emotions, and his own activities. A crowd can be very easily manipulated by those who understand the mechanisms of social manipulation, as all demagogues know very well. So therefore, those who take part in crowd activity are likely to do things that they would never dream of doing on their own. On the other hand, a small number of people making up a group are able to achieve vastly more than a collection of individuals working on their own. This is known as the increment of association and is well understood as a rule of social behaviour. The increment of association increases as the group grows until it reaches 6 to 12 people. If the group grows beyond that point, another law begins to operate, known as the natural law of diminishing returns. 100 electors working in 20 groups of 5 members will be far more effective than 4 groups of 25 people. 100 individuals in a group would be a crowd in which individual development and effective action is extremely difficult, if not impossible. It is therefore a principle of social activity that large numbers are not required to achieve results. Take, for example, the oldest movement that is affecting us today, the Christian movement. Christ started with 12 disciples, one of whom, in fact, was a bit of a disaster. Marxism was very much the same. Marxism started with Marx himself and a colleague, a millionaire called Friedrich Engels, plus a small group of others who established the communist movement. The Fabian movement was exactly the same. In 1883, Edward Peace invited a number of others to hear a Scottish-American teacher speak, and as a result of that, 9 of those young people went on to found the Fabian movement, which has penetrated now to every corner of the globe. Its influence is absolutely enormous. It began with just 9 people and grew from there. Lenin, the famous communist tactician, understood the value of small groups. In fact, one of Lenin's dictums was, "The fewer the better, provided that the fewer are better." Right through history, the communists have always purged their membership to provide greater discipline and dedication for a long-term strategy. All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. Edmund Burke firmly believed that. The question is, what must they do? The answer to that is that they must inform themselves, train themselves, and take the constructive political action required to defend the free society. Because the communist method of operation is so incredibly successful, it is going to be useful to borrow from some of their methods, though we don't recommend the morals of their activity. The communists traditionally have operated cell groups. Each member of a cell group is required to exert a certain amount of self-discipline. He is required to dedicate himself to the specific objectives of the communist movement, and he is required to submit himself to the necessities of the group. So too has it been found to be very effective for those who wish to defend the free society to form small groups. Free people can associate even if it is only for a very limited objective. They don't need to agree upon everything. They just need to be unanimous on their overriding objective, to defend and extend the free society. Part of that objective must also be to dedicate themselves with a certain amount of self-discipline in the defence of the free society. They may even disagree on a wide number of issues, but as long as they unite on their objective, the group is in fact strengthened by diversity in interests and ability. Let us then assess the structure of the successful action group. A structure is simply a mechanism which must serve the objective. Any form of constructive action group must have a leader, and a leader in this situation is self-selecting. The most appropriate person for the job will become obvious over a period of time. Action groups do not need a bureaucracy. If they have a clear objective in mind, then they don't need such things as minutes, secretaries, treasurers, or even voting. Those who belong to the group must accept personal responsibility for the integrity of the group and must also apply their own self-discipline and, in consultation with the group, determine their own action. as each group should aim at consensus on the objective and agree among themselves on who will do what, voting should not be necessary. Decision-making is best done as agreement between friends, the way families operate. They are not meeting to carry resolutions on what others should do. Each comes to consult and share with the other on what action he or she will take. This is agreed after general discussions by each person individually. In this way, the superstructure is avoided, though the benefits are retained. This approach is not possible in larger groups where formality is unavoidable. What is required in the environment in which we live is a new type of political movement based on voluntary service and staffed by trained citizens. When I say trained citizens, I mean those who are prepared to train and discipline themselves. They then become citizenship competent and can guide and advise electors on how to initiate constructive action in all political spheres. This is the kind of movement that this video series intends to foster. It is definitely not intended that these trained citizens be under any form of centralised control. It is intended that the individual should be able to take constructive action to increase his ability to govern his own affairs in a free society. It is worth observing that throughout the Soviet Union, it was these small, very private discussion and action groups, self-motivated and self-disciplined, which carried freedom forward and survived. They copied the works of Solzhenitsyn and the Gospels and then passed them around. They produced primitive news sheets for very selective and sometimes anonymous distribution. In the end, unable to be ignored or diverted, the dissident movement flourished. They grew to critical mass, which dramatically impacted on their nations. Once again, freedom moved across the face of the land, and it should be remembered that they were denied the sanctions of force and commercial enticement. It is important to stress that methods of operation should always be within the law. They should always be legal, and they should also bear moral scrutiny. The group doesn't necessarily have to have a name. It is a private action group for the purpose of meeting together to take some form of specific political action. So why bother? You are not seeking the immortality of an action group, but the achievement of a specific goal. An action group of this sort is organic in nature, in the same way that the human body has blood, brain, nerve and ligament cells and so on. The same is true in organisational terms. Different members of the group will have different functions. The leader, for example, has certain responsibilities. He must be responsible for the preparation of meeting details with such matters as the venue, time and other considerations. He is responsible to keep the meeting on track and to maintain order. The leader should be responsible for encouraging individual members of the group and to liaise between them. A leader also needs to be a good judge of consensus. The leader is often a very good tactician or strategist. A strategist must have an instinct or an understanding of when to do something, how to do it, and who to involve, also trying different methods to achieve results. Campaigns require leadership which is flexible as well as firm, and that is why a strategist is often the leader of the group. A strategist can make use of a wide variety of diverse tools such as opinion polls, surveys, rallies and so on. A strategist may also decide that the time is right to organise a debate, but always do this on your own ground if possible. A good action group should have somebody who is a competent researcher with a good knowledge of where to find information, such as statistics, electoral maps, addresses, and so on. A researcher needs to know where to find documents, how to find the right people, and how to collate information so that it is useful to the whole group. A media guide would help a researcher find the political editor for any magazine or journal in Australia. A useful aid is a who's who, so that information on people of influence can be checked immediately. Hansard is another useful source of information. A researcher needs to have a good filing system so that issues and individuals can be quickly researched and so that each action group understands the nature of those with whom they are dealing. And it is usually the job of a researcher to maintain a mailing list of those people who the group intends to keep informed of their activities and their research. Each action group needs to have a competent writer. Somebody with a talent for writing good newsletters, who can write brochures and produce posters. A good writer also needs to be able to teach others in the group how to effectively write letters, memos, and facsimiles, or whatever is required to communicate the message. It is also important for an action group to have a media specialist. This person should understand how newspapers work, someone who understands what editors, talkback hosts, and television programmers require. The media specialist could monitor letters to the editor so that those who make valuable contributions and constructive points can be added to the mailing list. A media specialist also needs to understand how to write a good press release. It could also be the job of the media specialist to build up a relationship with journalists and editors in the local area. Just about every action group has a number of people who don't immediately have any specific specialty. They are the people who will do almost any task and will be prepared to train themselves for tasks that take their interest. For example, they might have time to do photocopying, addressing envelopes, and so on. They might be the people who take responsibility for providing the group with printing, stamps, paper, and all the things that are required for a constructive action group. They may be the kind of people who can use the telephone during the day. For example, one ladies' group keeps in touch with their Member of Parliament, who is constantly receiving telephone calls from them on the education issue. They discuss the issue with him and make sure that he understands their reservations about current education policy. They have been very effective in the way that they have handled that campaign. There are also rules for the way a group should meet. These rules, naturally enough, are agreed upon by all members of the group, but it is important that the meetings are held regularly. We recommend that meetings are not any further apart than once a fortnight. The meeting must have agreed rules. For example, they should all start on time, and the members should agree upon a time when the meeting will finish. Obviously, there should be an agreement about who has responsibility for controlling the meeting, even if it is only for one night at a time. There should also be an agreement about the purpose of the meeting, which must be consistent with the purpose of the group. There are two basic purposes for a group of this sort. The first is educational, and the second is action. An educational group often performs various different tasks. It is usually by its very nature some kind of a study and discussion group where somebody will research a certain topic and prepare a talk or written report for the others. It may be a book circle where a group will agree to study a certain book and discuss it among themselves. Some of the best educational groups now employ audio and videotapes. The most important and most influential of the groups is the action group. The most important principle for this group is that they do something concrete. They do not meet to talk or drink tea, but to act. So therefore, they need an agenda. They need a clearly defined objective, even if it is a very broad one, like the extension of the free society. That gives them the clear opportunity to identify which policies promote the interests of the free society and form means of advancing those policies. An action group takes a very important objective of setting out to influence the course of events. In Western Australia, one action group has taken it upon itself to collect every newspaper published in the state and go through the letters to the editor. Any letter writer who produces a constructive letter making a useful point is placed on a mailing list and is contacted by members of the action group. This leads to regular communication with those who hold similar views and has produced a powerful network. Other activities could be putting together constructive ideas for influencing and informing other people. One group concentrates on politicians' wives. They say they have more sense than their husbands, over whom they have a high degree of influence. Another group has taken special note of those journalists who sometimes write sensible articles. They have discovered their home addresses, and every month they post them a booklet, cassette, or other information. After several years, they have profoundly influenced some journalists, who then drop material into the mainstream press. The most important aspect of the action group in the long term is letter writing. There are rules for letter writing, as there are for almost everything else, particularly the public letter. A letter to a politician or a person of influence needs to include the following things. It needs to be brief and courteous. Sarcasm is absolutely counterproductive. The byword for handling servants such as politicians and public servants is courtesy with firmness. It can be useful to ask a number of questions of a Member of Parliament to force him to think something through. It can be helpful to offer congratulations to a parliamentarian or someone of influence who has done something constructive. And finally, the main point of writing a letter to a politician is to create an awareness of what you believe or what you require from your representative. It is also important to understand a number of rules for dealing with the media. First, you should find out what the editorial rules are. Every column assigned to letter to the editor usually requires that the letters be brief, restricting people to 200 words or less. It is vital for anybody writing to the print media to check his facts exhaustively. It can be extremely embarrassing and damaging to your credibility to have incorrect information published in the letters to the editor column. It is useful to concentrate on the facts rather than the writer's opinions, although opinions in some cases are also rather important. Timing is important. It is difficult to get a letter published unless it is topical. It is important to have impact. Short, punchy, well-assembled letters are much more likely to be published than long, rambling, vague ones. It is very useful to have well-directed humour in a letter. Humour promotes communication. An open letter to a person in a position of influence, signed by a lot of people, can focus his mind on matters considered important by the group. Those who regularly write letters to the editor are actually training themselves. They can reach a point where they have nearly every letter published. The cost of the space devoted to your letters would be prohibitive if you had to buy it in advertising space. Clearly, the cost-effectiveness of letters to the editor makes this an extremely worthwhile pursuit. Almost everybody reads letters to the editor, and it is quite often possible to open up a debate on a specific issue. When that happens, a record of those who responded should be kept, especially of those who agree with you. With this list, it is possible to widen your circle of influence and lengthen your mailing list. The group that meets regularly has every opportunity to attract additional members, especially when they contact those who hold similar views. A point will come when the group expands beyond the number of, say, 12 people, when it becomes efficient to split the group. Another result of a group meeting over a long period of time is that more individual activity can take place outside the group. Individuals will maintain a loose association with the group, and the meetings may even become irregular with actions still taking place. The reason for this is that over time, members of the group become trained, competent, and self-motivated. In addition to that, special interest areas evolve and various members of the group begin to concentrate on particular areas of interest. In time, loose association with other like groups develops, followed by an infrastructure to service this communication, such as journals and seminars. Eventually, some issue or event may trigger a campaign. The campaign is a single issue effort that requires a concentration of activity in one particular direction. When a campaign of this kind is embarked upon, it is important to clearly identify the objectives. A principle of goal setting is to work out what is required to achieve that goal and then break it up into its component parts, giving each person responsibility for one part with the understanding that if each person does his job correctly, the objective can be reached. It is a feature of campaigns that groups usually find it much easier to combine against what they don't want than to combine for something that they do want. This is not necessarily a bad situation, because it does at least provide us with a mechanism that we can use to protect ourselves. Saying no can be a most valuable thing to do. Occasionally, a trust might be established to pursue one single issue. Such an organisation will require a chairman, and it will require some loose kind of structure. It will possibly require a postbox number and perhaps a bank account. It might require a press officer who can handle the media, do press releases, and manage advertising. If it is to be a long-term campaign, then a newsletter is often very constructive. Some newsletters may be registered as magazines and thereby qualify for cheaper postage. It is most important to remember that a campaign organisation is an action organisation. If possible, it should dispense with time-wasting things like keeping minutes and records of every small thing the group does. File the information and then press on. It is important to keep attention on the main objective and to submit everything else to that main objective. That is why a sense of strategy is so important. It is often useful to associate prominent people with the campaign if they can be persuaded to lend their name to an issue. The campaign may need a fundraiser. A wide range of activities are available for raising funds. However, many of the most efficient groups realise that it is easier to raise money in one's own profession, so they throw in, say, $50 each every few months and concentrate on the job in hand rather than running fundraising activities. An appeal to your mailing list contacts can be very successful, but always appeal for a specific project. For example, if appealing for funds to print brochures or run an advertisement in the local newspaper, always enclose a sample. Always show what they're getting for their money. Some permanent campaign groups may need formal membership in order to operate. However, one of the greatest traps in having a formal membership is in having a completely open membership. It is possible to draw up a constitution which allows for an invited membership only. History shows that an organisation with an open membership will inevitably include at least one Marxist in the membership. While this may be of strategic significance to the Marxist cause, it may be detrimental to the objectives of the group in question. Every political party in the country has always had a number of Marxists as members. Many a group has lost its structure, its money, the lot, by just having one meeting stacked by opponents. One of the most important aspects of political campaigning is to be able to identify and cooperate with allies. Those who become involved in political campaigning are going to come across the most unexpected allies. I believe the time is coming when those who want to extend and preserve the free society must go to those they may regard as their political enemies. For example, it may be necessary for businessmen to cooperate with unions, for conservatives to cooperate with socialists, and for all sorts of dissimilar viewpoints to come together, where they can agree upon certain specific and well-identified, though limited, objectives. There are, however, certain specific rules for cooperating with groups with whom you might otherwise strongly disagree. The rules are that you identify the issues upon which you do agree, clearly identify the common ground. Agree to cooperate on those issues and agree to put all areas of disagreement aside until the campaign is completed. This is a difficult principle for groups to adhere to, but where it has been mastered, the results have been extremely successful. There have been many instances in history where small, well-trained groups taking specific courses of action have actually changed the course of history. The abolition of slavery and the achievement of suffrage and secret political ballots are examples. One example that may reverberate right around the agricultural world, modest though it was, took place in the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia in 1988. This was known as Operation Bankwatch. The situation was that after 5 years of drought and poor commodity prices, a group of 300 or 400 farmers were in desperate straits. At least 200 were facing imminent bankruptcy. There didn't appear to be anywhere that they could turn for any form of relief. The National Farmers Federation said outright that 300 of them had to go broke and offered no help. The state government offered no relief. The local councils had no answers. They didn't hold sufficient voting sanctions to be able to influence enough members of parliament to gain any kind of assistance. Nobody knew what to do. It wasn't until a couple of individuals with training, such as this course fosters, got together and started a movement to meet the situation that the whole issue turned around. The first thing they did was to establish agreement among themselves about what their objective would be. After a number of small meetings, they were able to agree that the policy should be that no single farmer who wanted to remain on his property should be forced off it. No matter whether he was threatened by the banks or by the government or by anybody at all, their policy was that those who wanted to remain would be helped to remain. The first and most imminent threat was from the banks. The banks were obviously in a position to foreclose on a large number of farmers they regarded as insolvent. So, Operation Bankwatch was mounted. This was a carefully coordinated campaign to picket every bank on the Eyre Peninsula. The banks were challenged about some of their outrageous interest and service rates. local businessmen as well as farmers were encouraged to close their accounts and transfer them to other organisations like credit unions or building societies. And there is no doubt that the banks really felt the pressure. They lost 4,000 accounts in 1 week. A picket of the banks had never been tried before, but it created enormous interest in other parts of South Australia. The media coverage became heavier and heavier. The banks were in distress and the politicians became more and more uneasy. The bank watch people were challenged to provide some sort of an answer to the plight of desperate farmers. Their response in every case was simply to stick to their pre-organised policy, and that policy was that no farmer should be forced off his property if he wanted to remain. The bankers and politicians were told, "This is our policy. You find ways of putting that policy into practice. We will not be moved. This is our policy. We provide no solutions. We provide no suggestions. We just repeat that no single farmer who wants to remain will be forced off." Unable to entangle them in administrative matters, the politicians and banks had hit an immovable object. They knew the difference between policy and administration, and it made all the difference. They met each situation as it arose. At one critical point, the bankers were openly laughing at them. Bankwatch announced that the very first farmer evicted would be moved, with wife and family, furniture, milking cow, pet goats, the lot, onto the front lawn of a particular leading banker. A convoy of farm trucks would blockade the street and the eviction would be renegotiated. The bankers stopped smiling. They didn't want their responsibilities coming home to them, apparently. The end result was that the banks themselves did not dare to foreclose on one single property, even though the farmers had been told by their own organisations that they were uneconomic. The Governor of South Australia also became interested in the campaign and invited the leaders of the Bankwatch organisation to dine with him and explain their position. Once the immediate threat of foreclosing was removed, the leaders of the Bankwatch campaign decided that something practical had to be done to ensure that when rain came, the farmers could put their crops in. It was decided to hold a monster auction, and all the farmers were invited to contribute machinery that they no longer needed. The auctioneers offered their services free of commission. Machinery came from all parts of South Australia, and buyers came from nearly every state in the nation. When the auction was held, over $600,000 was raised. This formed the basis of the fighting fund. The fund was to be used in the aid of any farmer who wanted to put it in a crop but was unable to secure carry-on finance from any of the banking organisations. It was therefore possible to fulfil the policy objective with which they originally began. Not a single farmer was to leave his land unless he decided to go himself. The following season was a very good one, and many of the farmers saved by this campaign were able to completely re-establish themselves in just 1 year. Had it not been for a number of trained citizens who were able to supply leadership in a period of intense crisis when no other leadership was available, that community would now be decimated. This is a constructive example of action undertaken by a small number of people who were properly trained over a long period of time to understand what works. Though undergoing long, lonely periods of training under a form of self-discipline that is rare, and sometimes wondering if they would ever have an opportunity to use their expertise, they provided the kind of knowledge, will and sanctions that does move mountains. It is this kind of spirit that established free constitutions and free speech and established our parliamentary institutions and one of old those freedom potentials now enjoyed. Without dedicated individuals who are prepared to accept a demanding form of self-discipline in the service of their fellows, no society can expect to remain free. It cannot expect to advance personal sanctions and those freedom potentials now so little understood. Part of the purpose of this course is to help those who wish to fill that role, the role of service to other citizens. They may choose to serve in none of the ways specifically discussed, but in others. Freedom with diversity is its own best strategist. Our forefathers who fought for our independence through two world wars did not do so to have their sacrifices spurned by lazy descendants, nor by unimaginative ones, who would not build upon their inheritance.